teacher, and I'm going to tell a little bit on what new theorem has to do about the small parameter that we can build expansions in.
I'm sorry.
Could you elaborate a little bit on what new theorem has to do about the small parameter?
What? I couldn't get it.
About doing some calculations with expansions around using some small parameter. And then you answered something about doing that you can do an expansion using, and actually, I don't know, I didn't really follow that. So he asked you,
Neil Turk?
yeah, new to one of his questions was that there is no apparent small parameter that you could do expansions around in quantum gravity. And could you calculate anything then?
Yeah, I answered that yes, there is a small parameter
Yeah.
in the gravitational theory because one is computing things in some region, given a certain dimension, length scale of this region, and given some boundary data on this region. So any calculation is done with some boundary data. So the approximation, the expansion is good if two parameters are small. One is the ratio of the Planck scale to the size of what you're looking at, and one is the ratio of the size you're looking at to the curvature. So the approximation is good when space-time you're looking is not too curved, and when you look at large distance with respect to the Planck scale. The more you want to go to the Planck scale and the more you want to go to high curvature, the more terms you have to look in the expansion.
So do you do a perturbation series in two
Yeah.
parameters or?
Yeah.
That's very
Yeah,
important.
in a sense. No. You do a perturbation series in what I call N. So you have a certain expansion. This is given. Okay? It's not a perturbation theory in a small parameter. It's a certain expansion. And then you ask when this is good. And it is good when these two quantities are small.
Is there any sense in which Reggie calculus agrees with GR without taking the delta goes to infinity limit?
Yes. Yes, by definition of limit. I mean, if let me give you the precise statement. If you have a region of space time, a region of space time with a metric. Four-dimensional metric. You fix yourself some approximation, epsilon, whatever you want, then the Einstein-Hilbert action of that metric is a number. Okay? You can always find a triangulation such that the Regge action is epsilon close to the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay. That's a theorem. And now you can ask, and that relates to your question, now you can ask, okay, suppose I have a given space-time, okay, how fine should my triangulation be in order to get close to the classical one? And what you find out is that given a certain epsilon, the triangulation can be very coarse if your curvature is not very large. In other words, if you have a bunch of space-time with a very small curvature, then a very rough triangulation gives a very good approximation Reg action is a good approximation to the I3 limit action.
Can you write the metric in a piecewise flat manner somehow so that you could get a GR action with a piecewise flat metric?
Yeah, that's one way of doing this. Yes. You can think of piecewise
flat. That would be something.
Maybe it's not the most natural way, but it's one way. In fact, it's a way that many people have in mind. So you can approximate the metric itself with a piecewise flat metric, yes. This is going to play a role in the quantum theory, but be careful. Think about perturbation theory, time-dependent perturbation theory in standard quantum mechanics. If you have a particle subjected to a force, then the classical trajectory is curved, okay? Because the particle accelerates. Now, suppose you want to compute the transition amplitude in quantum mechanics, and suppose that you have a kinetic energy, you have potential, and you do first order perturbation theory. You do first order perturbation theory. What you do is you compute the amplitude from here to here by having propagator, one interaction with the potential propagator. Okay? So you approximate, you represent the trajectory as a flat, a straight an angle and straight. And to first order perturbation theory, you get a good approximation to the physical motion. This does not mean that you're considering trajectory boom, boom. Right? You only consider that you are in a certain approximation in this small parameter within the potential. Or even better, in QED, suppose you do electron-electron scattering. Okay? Now we know what is the classical physics of electron-electron scattering, right? They come, they go straight, but then there's an attraction, a repulsion, so they do a nice curve like that. And you can compute it, and this is easy calculation to do Rutherford scattering. Now you're doing QED. In QED, you say, okay, this is my electron, this is the other electron, there is an interaction of that sort. So each one of the electrons goes straight, take bump, and goes the other way. Obviously not. That's not what you're... This is a representation of what you're doing. So there is an approximation in which straight, bump, straight, integrating in the position of this, gives the amplitude. In fact, just first order in the Feynman expansion, you get the correct classical limit of this. Give the correct amplitude for the scattering. So there is a certain way of expanding the calculation for this scattering amplitude here, in which you replace the continuous curved classical trajectory with a piecewise flat trajectory. When you treat the metric in Regge calculus with a piecewise flat metric, you're doing exactly the same thing. You're computing an action, and then in the quantum theory, a transition amplitude, by representing it with piecewise flat terms, in the same sense in which piecewise flat the trajectory of the electron in QED. So it's not that one is describing piecewise flat metrics, but one is using piecewise flat metrics to do approximations to continuous metrics. We're going to see this to happen in the theory. Okay, ready to start? So, quantum physics without time, let me start by just reminding you what happened in the last lecture and wrapping up the last lecture, classical physics without time. I could summarize what came up from the last lecture by saying that the main idea is to have a variable X, which represents all the partial observables. So the thing that corresponds to position and also time. So x is really position and time, all the configuration variables and time. So x in a extended configuration space, which has dimension n plus 1 in mechanics if the number of physical degrees of freedom is n. Okay? And then the action is going to be given by a evolution in tau of the Lagrangian, x and x dot, where this action is invariant and arbitrary reprimitizations of x of tau. So it's invariant under x of tau going x of tau prime of tau, where tau prime is any function of tau. And we saw some example of that, right? X being qnt. I just show you. Now, if you do that, the Hamilton function is a function of x and x prime, so the initial position and final position, including time. The Hamiltonian is zero. And there is a constraint, c, function of x and p, for free particle is energy is equal p squared over 2m. So from the Hamiltonian point of view, it's the constraint that knows about the physics. If you know the Hamilton function, then you can get all the solution of the equation of motion by just taking the derivative with respect to x. This gives p minus p, function of x and x prime. And you can solve for x prime and have x prime as a function of p and x. So you can solve for the final partial observables as function of the initial ones. But you cannot solve for all of them, of course. You can solve for all of them minus one in the case of particle dynamics, right? You cannot solve for final position and final time, because if you have the initial data, nothing determines final position, final time. You can solve only for one of them. In fact, if you do write this explicitly, you can do it for a free particle. These are n, x is n dimensional, these are n equations, but they're always redundant. There's always only n minus one independent one. So the only thing you can get of that is at given x, you have some relation between the x prime. So if you know initial position, initial momentum, then you get a relation between final position. So if you know initial position, initial momentum, and initial time, you get a relation between the final position and final time. Right? So what you predict is not evolution in time, but is relations between the partial observables. Observables. And that's the entire idea of the physics without time. Instead of, you look perplexed.
No, I'm just thinking.
Sorry? I was just thinking it through in my head. Ah, okay. So the entire idea here is instead of picking up a variable and say, okay, let's see how all the other variables evolve with respect to that variable, just take all together and just say what are the relations between them imposed by the equation of motion. Good. So now we want to do the same in the quantum theory. And in the quantum theory, let me start from some basics. So forget no time for a moment. Let's just go back to basics. So we have a quantum theory, a quantum theory. So what does this mean? It means that we have a Hilbert space of states. We have some operators, Q I put a hat on operators sometimes, just when I want to make sure that I'm talking about operators. But then I'll forget the hat. And in usual quantum theory, we have time, of course. So these are some variables. Okay, and the evolution is given by a Hamiltonian. We'll put a hat now. Which is an operator on H. So it is captured by a unitary operator. The Hamiltonian self-adjoint, which is the evolution operator, is minus I over H bar H t. And the main object of interest for doing physics, and in fact this is the key object on which we'll focus, are the matrix element of the evolution operator, which are the transition amplitudes. So this is the key object, the transition amplitude. Or amplitudes, is, you know, in classical mechanics, you know the initial something and you compute the final something. In quantum mechanics, you know the initial something and you compute the probability of some final something. And the probability is the square of the amplitude. And what is the amplitude is the matrix element of this operator there. So suppose we have a set of operators which is complete and commuting in sense of Dirac. So I can write, I can choose a basis which diagonalize these operators. Okay, so think about position. So I have the position eigenbasis. And in the position eigenbasis, I write a, I look at the matrix element of that. So I write a function, which I call W, which depend on some initial eigenstate at some initial time t, and on some final eigenstate at some final time t, and is defined as the matrix element of the evolution operator between the position at time q prime, the evolution between time t prime and time t, and the position at time q. If you know these objects, you know everything about the quantum dynamics. Basically, you know the story about dynamics, dynamical, because then there is a kinematical story, which is the quantization, the eigenvalues. But the dynamical part is all coded here. Good. So this is the basic object we'll think about. Now, if you're following, there is an immediate observation, like, oh, look, it has the same variables as the Hamilton function. Right? Depend on the same variable as the Hamilton function. So let me make a completely trivial calculation that you probably have seen zillions of times. I don't know. But just to remind you, suppose I compute q prime, t prime, q and t. Do I put the prime in front of q, t, q prime? I never know which way I put the prime. For a free particle. Okay? Let's compute it explicitly for a free particle. It just takes a couple of lines. So for a free particle, this is going to be q prime e to the I over h bar p squared over 2m. Operator, that's the Hamiltonian of a free particle, t prime minus t q. Okay? And the easiest thing to computing that is insert here a resolution of the identity for p states, because then diagonalizes that. So this becomes, just continue straight, this becomes the integral dp, and another one here, the integral in dp prime of qp, p e over h bar p squared over 2m t prime minus t, p q prime, p prime, p prime, p, p q. Okay? Now, the operator p, of course, is diagonal in the p basis, so it's acting here is just a number, p is not an operator anymore, and so, and goes out from that, and this gives a delta function between p and p prime, so I'm just one integral, and the matrix element between p and q is just the Fourier transform, one of the other, right, at the basis that of two conjugate operators. So this is just the integral in dp of, so this is e to the I pq with a bar one of the two. And the delta function transforms this p prime to p. So this is going to be e to the I need an h bar downstairs, p times q minus q prime plus I h bar p squared over 2m p prime minus t, which is a nice Gaussian integral. That, so the Gaussian integrals are what we theoretical physicists do all the time. So is an integral in p squared. This is the p term. So of course, the result of that is, let's see, e to the, so the p squared conjugate thing is q, so we get q prime minus q square. The h bar remains downstairs. The m and the t minus t prime goes downstairs, right? So m, I have 2m, but then I need a 4 downstairs, so 2 t prime minus t. And believe me, this is the, and then the factor here is the one that needs to make this just a square, so it's going to be something like the square root of h bar 2m t prime minus t or something like that, up to some mistake. Okay, that's this is notebooks. Now, what's the interesting thing here? Not only this has the same variables that the Hamilton function, but this is the Hamilton function, right? We computed it. It is exactly the Hamilton function. Okay. Now, this is a free particle. Everything is very simple. But it is true in general, and I'll assure you that the transition amplitude, it's proportional to e to the I over h bar, the Hamilton function. To lowest order in h bar. So to the lowest order in h bar, if you think that h bar is small, look at here. If you think that h bar is small, this is a phase. This is an exponential that varies fast because h bar is small. This is something that varies slowly. So the fast varying part of the transition amplitude is given by the exponential of the Hamilton function plus h bar correction. Now, let's write these transition amplitudes next chapter, always about the transition amplitude, but let's now bring Feynman in, right? So Feynman told us to think about this transition amplitude as given by a functional integral. So let me remind you how this, what he did, because the details of what he did are interesting. Qt, Q prime, T prime. The way he did it is to, so this is the definition of the thing, is to use the fact that U of T minus T prime, U of T prime minus T second, so the evolution operator, it defines a group, so this is T minus T second, right? So you can take the evolution operator and multiply it and you get an evolution operator. So Feynman's idea is that let's take time, this is T prime, let's pick a number n, which then we want large, but for the moment it's not large. Later it's going to be much larger than one, but just a minute. And let's chop this in n pieces and call epsilon t prime minus t divided by n. So epsilon is the time interval divided by n. And then, of course, I can rewrite this as q prime and the product. In fact, I can write it as a product for little n going to 1 to big N of little matrix element of qn u of epsilon qn plus 1, where q0, qn plus 1 are appropriately defined. This makes sense. Okay? No. Sorry. Let me. No, it's not right. Let me just write explicitly, otherwise I get confused. So it's a q prime u of epsilon, u of epsilon q. Okay, that's the product, not the. Okay. Now let's insert everywhere resolutions of the identity dq n, dq1, q1, q1, etc. So this can be written as a multiple integral dqn. One per each insertion here of matrix elements. Now I can write it correctly. Qn u epsilon qn plus 1. There's no approximation here. This is an exact formula. Okay? And this is true whatever large n is. So in particular, it is also true if I take the limit for n going to infinity, right? So this is also equal and is still exact. That's the limit as n going to infinity of dqn. Now this is a this is a multiple integral with for each n with an arbitrary large number of integrations of this matrix element here. But now if n is very large, epsilon is very small. And let's imagine, that's what Feynman did in his thesis, that the Hamiltonian here is p squared over 2m plus some potential. So let's just consider a particle with some potential in that case. And then what happens? That u epsilon is e to the I p squared over 2m epsilon plus v of q epsilon. And this is the exponent of a sum of operators. This is the exponent of the first times the exponent of the second, okay, times the corrections, which depend on the commutator of these two, but the commutator is epsilon squared. So Feynman and the Italian mathematics that he's using all the time say, well, n is large, so epsilon is small, so the commutator is going to be small. Let's forget about it. Okay? So this is going to be e to the I p squared over 2m epsilon times e to the I v of q epsilon plus something which is going to be small. Forget about it. Okay, every mathematician would horrify for this sort of arguments, but that's what works in physics. So what? But now I have to compute the matrix element of these things here. But this is in the Q basis, is diagonal, so it just goes out of the matrix element because it's in the Q. This is a Q operator, so it's just the number. And this is what I just computed before, is that thing there. So the matrix element Qn plus 1 U epsilon Qn is nothing else that that thing there. Forget the square root that we'll just absorb here. That's later on in the definition of the limit. And just let's look at the interesting part of it. I over h bar qn plus 1 minus qn square over 2 tn plus 1 minus tn. Okay. E to the I this, but now these are numbers. So I can bring them together for free. So plus V of Qn epsilon. Now epsilon, okay. Epsilon, this is also an epsilon. Tn plus 1 minus Tn is an epsilon. So this is an epsilon. And in fact, let me write it as epsilon square and an epsilon outside. And for some reason, I got the sign wrong. There should be a minus there. I don't know where it comes from. There's a minus. Oh, yes, because there's a minus when I can change sign there. There's an overall minus. So what is this? Well, before asking what is this, let's bring everything together. So the W is going to be equal to the limit for n going to infinity of the multiple integral, dqn, there will be some factors coming from that thing there, of the product of all these things here, but it's a product of exponential, so it's the exponential of a sum, ih bar goes out, and here I have the sum, little n going from 1 to n, of this thing here. Okay? And this sum, it's obviously, let me copy it. Qn plus 1 minus Qn square over epsilon square minus V of Qn everything times epsilon is a discretization of the action. Right? So the transition amplitude can be written as a multiple integral of a discretization of the action in the limit in which you take the discretization to zero, which is the opposite of Feynman then decides to write in the form q t t prime equal the functional integral e to the I over h bar s of q, the action. So that's the definition of the functional integral, the meaning of the functional integral. And in physics, we use functional integral all the time, but either they mean this, or they mean that if there's no this term, or if this term is only quadratic, we can do the Gaussian integral. We can do the Gaussian integral. So the functional Gaussian integral can be done, and everything else is just perturbation expansion around it. So remember, in physics, functional integrals are either a way to keep track of perturbation expansion or just limits of multiple integrals. When you use them formally in QED, for instance, it's just a way for packaging the perturbation expansion. When you use them in QCD, in lattice QCD, your functional integral is exactly means a limit of the multiple integral. And now you see why this is going to be true in general, because in this integral here, or in the multiple integral equally, if you are in a regime where h bar is small, if you're computing transition amplitude from initial position, final position, such that the classical physics is good enough, or is approximately good, then you can consider h small. And then this is an oscillating integral with a small parameter in front of it. And the mathematics tells you that this is dominated by the saddle point approximation. In other words, the oscillation of this are going to cancel everywhere except where the variation of this is zero. And the variation of this is zero in the classical solution. So therefore, this is going to be dominated by e to the I h bar s on the classical solution determined by q t, q prime, and t prime, which is the Hamilton function. Okay? It's defined to be the Hamilton function. S of q prime, t prime, q and t. Or q t, q prime, and t prime. Okay? So the transition amplitudes are given by the exponential Hamilton function, lowest order in h bar, and this all this is going to play a role in the following. All this for with time. Now let's do the same thing without time. That's what I could do all that starting from this action here. No reason not to redo all that starting from this action here. If I do this starting from this action here, I compute the transition amplitudes, which in principle are just transition amplitudes. So now let's take away time. So a priori, I would expect transition amplitude x, x prime, x tau, x prime, tau prime. But you will not be surprised by discovering that this is going to be independent of tau and tau prime, right? In the small h bar limit, because obviously they're going to be dominated by the Hamilton function, which is independent of tau and tau prime, because this is. But this is going to be true in general, because you're integrating over trajectories, the exponential of the action. And the action is independent of tau, doesn't know anything about tau. It only depends on the actual trajectory in the x space, the qt space. So obviously, from the same definition, this is going to be just a function of x and x prime. Okay. But careful, it's not going to be given by the same expression here. It's going to be given by a completely different expression, because I'm integrating now in dx of tau. So both in q of tau and t of tau, if there's position and time. OK? And now something magic happens. And this is what is not in textbook at all, but tau and everything. And you heard an anticipation of that in the colloquium yesterday. And the magic thing that happens is the following. When you do the discretization of the action, you see epsilon is t prime over t over n. So n is here, here, and here. If you start from an action which is invariant under the optimization of tau, n is only here and not there. Let me show you explicitly how this works. Suppose you start, let me show it in an example. An action which was d tau, yesterday action, q dot square over t dot m2 plus, let's put a potential, minus, let's put a potential, t dot v of q. So this is an action for two variables, q and t, invariant under the parameterization of tau. Now let me discretize it as n. This is going to be the sum, little n 1 to n, epsilon, okay, n half qn plus 1 minus qn square over epsilon squared, okay, tn plus 1 minus tn over epsilon minus tn plus 1 minus tn over epsilon v of qn. Okay? Now, epsilon squared downstairs, epsilon upstairs go away, epsilon upstairs, epsilon downstairs go away. So this depend on n only through the number of steps. The Lagrangian, the Lagrangian's time, the measure here, it's independent of n. It's just n over 2 qn plus 1 minus qn square divided tn plus 1 minus tn, tn plus 1 minus tn, v of qn. Okay. There's no n here, no capital N here, no epsilon. The only place where capital N happens is here. Why? Because now you have a final path integral where you're not just integrating over the position of the particle, you're also integrating over the time, the position of this time steps here you're choosing. You're integrating over these as well. So therefore, there is no small parameter here. The only small parameter is the number of steps you're taking. This is a disappearance of the small parameter that I talked about yesterday in the general covariant form of discretized system, or in the discretization of general covariant system. Okay? So careful, this is non-trivial, and this is, everything seems trivial so far, but when you bring things together, this. So what is the quantum theory now? I'm already using all the. Can go there. So full quantum theory. Without time. So remember, x is both configuration variables and time. So there will be functions of x, so a Hilbert space, which, however, cannot be the standard Hilbert space of quantum mechanics, is larger. So it's, let me call it extended, and there will be operators here. So I have a Hilbert space of a generalized Hilbert space of states with operators x and p. So position, time, momentum, and energy. Okay. The Hamiltonian, remember, is zero, so nothing evolves there. There could be no evolution there, but there is a constraint. So the physical states have to satisfy this constraint. So the physical states have to satisfy C of psi equals zero. The states that satisfy this constraint, or generalized states that satisfy this constraint, form a Hilbert space H, which is a subspace of that space there, or maybe a completion if there is a continuous spectrum delta functions, that are the solutions of this equation here, the physical state that. So there will be a projector from the extended Hilbert space to the physical Hilbert space, which project on the solutions of this constraint equation here. And W of x and x prime, the transition amplitudes, are just the matrix element of this projector here. I'm going to show you an example concretely how it works and why it gives the same thing. Okay. So let me make the simplest possible example. A free particle, again. Okay. So x for a free particle is position and time. So the states here are functions of q and t. These are the states in H extended. The Hamiltonian is zero, but there is a constraint. And the constraint, we have seen what it is pt plus p squared minus 2m, the Hamiltonian of the corresponding time evolving system, is zero. So this equation here, cpc equals zero, which is a constraint equation, let's write it explicitly, is a p operator over p squared over 2m operator acting here. So it's ih bar d over dt psi is equal minus h bar squared over tn d over dq squared. So it's a Schrödinger equation, time-dependent Schrödinger equation. So the constraint that doesn't know anything about time in the theory that doesn't know anything about time, if you write it explicitly, is a time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Its solutions are easy to find in that case because, for instance, I go in momentum space, right? If I write the Fourier transform function of P and E, let's call it with a standard name, which is Fourier transform of the function of Q and T, then this equation here becomes E minus P squared over 2N psi of p and e equals zero, whose solution is all the functions of energy and momentum, which are given by an arbitrary function of momentum and delta e minus p squared over 2m. Right? It has to support on that. So if I go back to configuration space, all the function of q and t, which I can write as I Fourier transform back this one, an arbitrary fp e to the I p x, but the dependence on time is going to be given by plus p squared over 2m t, okay, of h bar. So the space and the space of these functions are the space in H, the actual physical Hilbert space. So the physical Hilbert space is a space of solutions of the equation of motion, right? The space of Schrödinger wave function with their full time evolution. Okay? And what is the transition amplitude? Well, the transition amplitude depend on x and x prime. So it's going to be a transition amplitude function of q, t, q prime, and t prime. And it's going to be given by the matrix element of the projector on the solution of this thing here. Well, the projector on the solution of this thing here is delta of pt minus p squared over 2m. Is the operator that projects on the functions where pt is p squared over 2m. So in configuration space, it's just going to be given by the Fourier transform of that. So dp de delta of p squared minus of pt minus p squared over 2m, and then the Fourier transform EIP q minus q prime plus e t minus t prime. So I do the integral in E. I take away that, and I just write here p squared over 2m. And so this is a Gaussian integral. And if I do it, it's exactly the Gaussian integral I did before. So this is going to give I over h bar q prime minus q squared over m 2 t prime minus t with this is the same as before with the same factor here, whatever. Okay, so the w that we saw before. Okay, so you see, we have a formulation here. This one of quantum mechanics, in which the only object you have are partial observables, okay, the conjugate momentum, a constraint, and transition amplitudes. You never say which one of your observables is time. You never worry about time, but you get exactly all the predictions of the quantum theory, and in the limit in which you look where h bar is small, all the predictions of the classical theory. This is a language. In fact, you say, well, why doing all that? Well, because in general relativity, we don't have a t variable to single out. So we're forced to go to this language. We'll have partial observables. We'll have a constraint. We'll have a functional integral like that. We'll have transition amplitudes. All these things survive. What does not survive is the split of x into q and t. But we don't need it. This is not what we're interested about. Okay? Yes?
Is it true that like we distinguished the role of time, we just moved it into the constraint? So like the constraint makes it non-consular?
That's right. That's correct. Except that the theory like general relativity, you just get the constraint all packed. And you cannot disentangle time out. But it has no physical meaning to disentangle time out. If you read Newton, Principia, it's a beautiful point where he starts talking about time, because he has to argue against Descartes. And he says, well, finally, what is time? And he says, well, time is not something I observe. In fact, that's Newton. He says, I never observe time. I have clocks, okay, clocks have handles. I have some position of things. I always see position of things. So what I really see in the world is many things that change altogether, so to say. But then it's convenient to add one variable, which is time, by selecting one object that I call clock, which is the one with respect to which evolution is easier to describe. So if you go back to the origin of the formulation of physics as equation evolving in time, which is Newton, you realize that that is not natural, it's artificial. You're picking out one variable, and because it because the evolution of the other with respect to that looks good. But when you go to general relativity, there isn't a single variable such that the evolution of the others with respect to that one looks good. And so you have to just think that there are many variables just going around, and your equations say how they dance together, so to say. In specific cases, you can choose one and evolve one. But in specific cases, in general, in general relativity, there isn't a variable more timely than the other. Let me give you an example. Suppose I have I want to measure the time. Suppose I'm describing a satellite goes around the Earth, the GPS, which has its own clock, and I have my own clock here, and I want to describe the discrepancy between the two. Then I can say, okay, this is a true time, and this other clock is sort of off time, and I measure how it evolves with respect to that. But why not do the opposite? That clock is a true time, and this is off time. Well, let me give you even a better example. If you have studied GR, suppose this is a clock, this is another clock, I do that, okay? When I come back, So I launch it up and I take it back. And then when I come back, they are not equal anymore, right? Because one has moved. Which one is a true time? I would say, well, this one. Well, now let's go to your generativity courses. Between 2 points, you might want to say that the true time is the geodesic, the length of the geodesic between the two. But the geodesic is this one, not this one. This is accelerated. This is free falling. So the true time between now and now, if you look at what is written in your general relativity courses, is not what is measured by the clock, this clock here. It's measured by a clock which has been thrown up and coming down, right? So what is true time in general relativity? It's a complicated, useless notion, true time. Okay? It's much easier to forget about it completely. And in fact, in quantum gravity, you have to forget about it, otherwise you get confused. And you just have variables, length, position of handles of objects, measurement of clocks along given world lines, and all of that. And what the equation of motion are giving is how this, all the constraints between these things, how these things related to one another. So the question is, can we do physics in this way without having saying which one is a time variable? Yes, we can. We can in the classical theory, and that's the synthesis of it. We can in the quantum theory, and that's the synthesis of it. So now that we have the scheme to do quantum gravity, we have just to get the definition of this object here, or equivalent of this projector on physical state here, or equivalent of this constraint here, or equivalently of this functional integral here, the functional integral with the one in which I integrate in H, in X, not the one in which I integrate in the one is under. Okay. So any one of these strategies was going to define quantum gravity, either this functional integral here for this object, or defining this quantum constraint here. Okay, quantum constraint is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in general relativity. That functional integral is the Hawking, Hartle, Meissner, Hartle, Hawking functional integral. In general, there would be no Schrödinger equation, because Schrödinger equation involves evolution in time. There would be no unitary evolution, because there's no preferred time with respect to which to evolve. So it's a very good point this to stop, because don't underestimate this part of the story, even if it's simpler. From this tomorrow, today is Thursday, right? So tomorrow is Friday. There is no, it's Good Friday. Why the British, the American call it Good Friday? Because Jesus was hanged. It's one of the strangest thing for a non English speaking person to digest for that. So there's we meet again on Monday and we start with general relativity there. So just write general relativity in the proper way, and then from that I'll need a couple of mathematical tools, which you probably don't know, like the unitary representation of the Lorentz group, and then we'll just get to the writing the quantum theory of gravity and work with it. Okay. So have a nice Good Friday and all the rest.